Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. I'm Dawn Davenport, and I am an attorney and a writer specializing in the areas of infertility, adoption, and children's issues. I'm also the author of The Complete Book of International Adoption, a step-by-step guide to finding your child, published by Random House. I have a website that focuses on infertility and all forms of adoption, and the name of that site has recently changed to Creating a Family, and it can be found at, as you would imagine, www.creatingafamily.com. This show is live every Wednesday from 12 to 1 Eastern Time, and all the old shows are available at creatingafamily.com, so you can listen to them whenever you want, and thanks to the miracle of podcast, you can listen to them wherever you want. Today is the first show of a three-part series on the dilemma faced by couples trying to decide what to do with unused frozen embryos. Today's show will be a general overview of the issue, and then next week, May 28th, that show will be on the option of donating to another infertile couple. And the last show, June 4th, will be on the option of donating excess embryos to research. My guests on today's show are Dr. Anne Drapkin-Lyerly. She is with Duke University, where she is an associate professor in the departments of obstetrics and gynecology and at the Trent Center for Bioethics, Humanities, and the History of Medicine. She is also the lead author of the latest research on couples' preferences for embryo disposition. We also have Nanette Elster. She is the director of the Health Law Institute at DePaul University College of Law. She's also a bioethicist and a genetic and reproductive health attorney with Svensson Elster PC in Chicago. And last but certainly not least, we have Dr. Michael J. Tucker. He's an embryologist and the scientific director at Georgia Reproductive Specialist in Atlanta and the scientific director at Shady Grove Reproductive Science Centers, with offices in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. Wow, that was a mouthful for all of you guys. Thank you all for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Well, I think we're going to have to begin today's show getting our listeners up to speed because various people will come to this discussion with information on different levels as to how embryos are created, how we even get frozen embryos in the first place. So, Dr. Tucker, if you could explain very briefly how embryos are made in the IVF process, the in vitro fertilization process.
You said quickly and easily, not all simple things.
Yes, of course. That's why I directed it to you.
As brief as I can be, we simply take sperm from a husband, eggs from a wife, and through processing these, those actually retrieving them can be quite a long-winded process, but nevertheless, once we get them together, we generate embryos in the lab by mixing the eggs and sperm in a culture dish, and if we have very few sperm or poor quality sperm, we'll actually pick up single sperm and inject those into the eggs, generate embryos, and it's often the case we'll have 10, 20 eggs or more from an individual retrieval from a woman, thereby creating or generating, I like to use that term, often an excess number of embryos. We will transfer between 1 to 3, generally speaking, during a fresh in vitro fertilization cycle, and this will mean that by no means do we freeze all the excess embryos, some just arrest in development, but any that look potentially viable, we will freeze for later use. On average, 50% of all couples that go through in vitro fertilization will end up having between 1 to sometimes up to 20 embryos frozen. In the context worldwide, about 350,000 babies have been born worldwide from frozen thawed embryos, so it's a very important element of what we do, and this represents approximately 10% of all IVF babies born worldwide.
And more cycles are using frozen eggs now than each year. The percentage of cycles that use frozen embryos is increasing. Is that correct?
Absolutely. The last few years, we've seen major strides forward in the culture technology, so we're actually doing a better job in being able to get pregnant women with fewer embryos. Many, many more transfers where we put back just a single embryo, mimicking what happens in nature, reducing multiple implantations, which is a wonderful thing obstetrically. And yes, because of that reduction in number of embryos and the improvement of the quality overall, we're actually seeing more embryos effectively being frozen.
And how, what's the pregnancy success rate using frozen embryos? And I realize that that varies by clinic throughout the United States.
By rule of thumb, you could say all ages and all diagnoses, the fresh using fresh embryos, you're looking at between 35 to 40% take-home baby rate using fresh embryos. This is taken down to about 75% of that success figure using the frozen thawed embryos. So on average, somewhere between 35% of embryo transfers following a thaw achieve a pregnancy. Now, the reason for that is principally because we choose the best looking embryos up front. So we pre-select for better success in the fresh cycle, and the frozen embryos tend to be the ones which are not chosen up front. If I could just say that overall, 95% of all the embryos that we generate that we freeze get utilized by the couple that they're actually frozen for in the first place. So although there's probably, well, you'll probably give us the figures, Dawn, but the number of embryos out there frozen in the U.S. is a lot, but many of those are earmarked and will go back to the couples that they were generated for.
Well, you raise an interesting question about the actual number of embryos frozen in the United States, and the last count that was done was based on data current through April 2002, you know, basically 6 years ago. That count was about 400,000. I'm in the process of researching a book on this topic and will be estimating this number more closely. But for now, I think I would feel comfortable saying that there's over 500,000, but we actually don't know.
That's the figure I normally bandy around. So.
Like kind of the 500,000 figure, yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. Tucker and some others are going to be helping me try to become refine that number a bit. I think it might help right now to explain both the size and the developmental stage of the embryos at the time they are being cryopreserved, cryopreserved being the technical word for freezing. It's my understanding that at the cryopreservation stage, even if they've been grown to the 5 stage, which is called the blastocyst stage, even at that stage, the cell division has been all inside the egg or inside the outer covering of the egg. Is that correct?
In essence, any time from fertilization onwards and when fertilization occurs, the egg effectively becomes an embryo, but really
right.
Doesn't do a whole lot. It stays at a single cell. From that stage all the way through the 5th or even 6th or sometimes the 7th day of development, because sometimes embryos are slower from different couples, we can freeze successfully at any individual developmental stage. And between the first day of development when fertilization is established all the way through to the latest point at which we can maintain these embryos outside of the body, that is called the pre-implantation stage, the cell number will go from 1 up to about 150 to 200 cells. And the vast majority of that growth, as it were, or cellular division, occurs within the same or the original volume of the egg size. So there's no actual overall increase in the size of the embryo. It just subdivides into smaller and smaller numbers of cells till it reaches about 150.
About the size of a human egg, would that be a fair way of estimating
yes.
size?
And just to give people some visual idea of that, the human egg is about 120 microns across. That's about the thickness of a human hair. That's about a tenth of 1 millimeter. So it's pretty small, but nevertheless it's the largest cell in the human body.
How long can embryos stay frozen and still be viable?
Well, assuming they're maintained in the liquid nitrogen at nearly minus 200 Celsius, which is where they sit, all biological activity is completely arrested at that temperature. And in fact, studies using mouse embryos have shown that even 10,000 years worth of background radiation, those embryos can be thawed out and they're brand new. Effectively, if the conditions at minus 200 Celsius are maintained in the liquid nitrogen, those embryos are good to go for as long as they're in there. And that's true for sperm or for eggs or indeed embryos. So no expiry date on this.
What impact?
Of course, that raises other ethical issues. But
well, yeah, that hence this discussion. What impact does freezing have on their viability? Or I guess another way of asking that was, what percentage of embryos will survive the thaw?
The technology is such that we've gone from 50 to 60% survival rates back in the 80s, mid-80s, when I first started freezing, to routinely getting over 90% survival of all embryos that we freeze. So you're looking at a pretty good success rate. And indeed, is it the freeze procedure or the cryopreservation procedure itself that damages the embryos, or were they just not made of the right stuff in the first place? It's become clear that the level of technology is now so good that really the embryos that do not survive tend to be perceived as having been culled out of the group, in a sense.
You know, what's amazing to me is I was reading that it's possible to sustain a pregnancy with an embryo that has lost up to half, I think it is, of its cells through cryo-injury, which is absolutely amazing to me.
Yeah, the ability for these early-stage pre-implantation embryos to recover and generate pregnancy is remarkable. It's a testament to the plasticity of the early ability for the cells to differentiate and turn into different cell lines according to need.
Dr. Lyerly, if there are ethical issues associated with what to do with frozen embryos that aren't going to be used by the couple in another try for pregnancy, why freeze them at all? What's the upside?
Well, as can be surmised from all of the things we heard from Dr. Tucker, embryos are almost always frozen because people are hoping to have a baby. And sometimes they have the children that they hope they will have from their fresh cycles, and sometimes they don't. And freezing embryos gives you another way to reach your goal of creating a family. And
from the impact of the woman's on the woman's body, compare a fresh embryo that where you have to go through the ovulatory stimulation drugs, the surgery for the egg retrieval, and then a fresh transfer versus the impact on a woman's body using a frozen embryo.
Well, absolutely. So the processes that women have to go through to remove the eggs from their ovaries are not, if you will, as simple as getting sperm from their male counterpart. So women have to go through...
Isn't it always the case that it's harder, you know? Why is it that way?
but they take injectable drugs to induce ovulation. Sometimes the use of these medications can make women very sick and sometimes have to be hospitalized. And needless to say, it's also uncomfortable. Eggs are usually retrieved by putting a needle through the vaginal wall or the abdomen. And so needless to say, again, it's quite uncomfortable. So the whole process of egg retrieval is quite demanding on women's time and health. So once you have those eggs, you've created embryos, and you have the embryos, it's advantageous not to have to go through that process again. Also, as Dr. Tucker alluded to, we've been moving away from transferring the number of embryos, moving away from transferring several embryos and moving towards transferring one embryo at best, but one to three. And so if you create 10 to 20 embryos and you want to help the woman have the safest pregnancy, which would be a singleton pregnancy, then you want to transfer as few embryos as possible to her uterus, and then you'll have a number of embryos left over. And again, it's less of a health burden for her to transfer those frozen embryos than it would be to go through another fresh cycle involving egg retrieval and hormone stimulation.
And sometimes I believe that it's actually a medical necessity not to do a fresh transfer for whatever reason at that time. Maybe the woman has been hyperstimulated or whatever, and she really isn't able to go through a fresh transfer at the time of egg retrieval and where the embryos are created. And, you know, as much as we may not want to talk about it, the reality is money is a factor. IVF is expensive, and most of the time this disease is not covered by insurance. And a frozen egg transfer is about a third the cost of a regular IVF cycle where you have to go through the ovulation, induction, and then egg retrieval. So, you know, money is a factor, like it or not, in this arena that we're talking about. Now, Ms. Elster, this is where I think our language starts to break down. I was going to say who, and I think the correct choice would be owns or has a responsibility of deciding what to do with the embryos once they're frozen.
This is generally the decision of the people who are providing the egg and the sperm. Just like any other part of the body, we typically can control what happens to it. Given that once the egg and sperm are combined, it becomes an embryo, and the status of the embryo in the eyes of the law and the ethical realm is really uncertain, but those best equipped to make the decision would be the couple.
And so that's not the case. That is the case in almost all states, but it is certainly possible for the state to pass legislation which would take rest control away from the couple that has created them. Wouldn't that be the case as well, or isn't that possible?
It seems like that would pose some tremendous constitutional challenges, including falling well within the right to procreate, procreative liberty, et cetera. And it would depend what the state was planning on doing, but to utilize those embryos for other people's reproduction would seem unlikely given the line of case law that we have that seems to support a right not to procreate. Now, we do see in other countries, such as in the UK, there's a storage limit of 5 years if those embryos have not been utilized and there has not been a new re-upping of the time period by mutually agreed upon by the couple. Those embryos can be destroyed, but that is the only option for their use within that country without the explicit consent of the individuals who created the embryo. And it does seem unlikely that in this country we would see legislation like that because there is such a protection around reproductive freedom and procreative liberty.
But although there could be laws that would be passed that would prohibit the donation for research.
There already have been. South Dakota is one of those states where it's actually a criminal penalty.
Right, and Louisiana, I think, is another one, and there are certain other states that have. If you want to, if our listeners are interested in information on this, I know that Resolve, the National Infertility Association, does keep track of legislation such as that, and they have it on their advocacy page just for those
right.
of us.
And there's also a regularly updated list of embryo laws at the National Council for State Legislators, ncsl.org. And that's updated regularly.
NCL.org?
NCSL.org.
Oh, I will put that on my site as well so that if anybody wants to link to that. Just very briefly, if a couple divorces, or what if one dies, what if they both die, who decides do they have to follow the couple's wishes?
Oh, I wish that was an easy question.
I know that the law is all over there. It makes it for some fascinating reading.
There's no straightforward answer here, unfortunately. what we've seen in the line of case law regarding disputes in a divorce is not, it isn't very straightforward, except in the fact that all of the decisions have come out, obviously coming at that decision in a different way, but have all come out stating that the individual choosing not to procreate is the one who is successful. This is regardless of whether there have been forms signed in advance, and it's the idea that people might change their mind. What they sign before they even have embryos in place may be very different when a couple is undergoing a divorce or even after they've already had children.
Mm-hmm.
So there really is no clear-cut answer there. In the event of a death of one or both, this is very complicated, and generally our advice in our practice is that once embryos are created, couples should have an estate plan in place that states whether they'd want a surviving partner to go ahead and utilize those embryos. If so, would they want a child conceived after their death, so in essence a posthumously created child, would they want that child to be an heir of their estate, to be considered their legal child? That would be information that could come through in a will. And then what happens in the event both parties die? Although there might be a form filled out with the fertility center, fertility centers aren't going to necessarily have that information that both of the individuals have passed away, and therefore it would be important for an administrator or executor of an estate to notify the fertility center to ensure that whatever choice was determined would be carried out and fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of unanswered questions. We don't really have clear-cut determinations. Now, some states do have laws whether those children created posthumously can inherit, can be considered legal children, but this, again, is something variable from state to state.
All right. At some point, the couple or the woman decides not to keep trying for another pregnancy. Hopefully they've been successful and they don't want it. They were able to conceive and they don't want more children, or maybe they've decided to move to a different way to become a parent, or maybe they've decided to live child-free. In an ideal world, the last frozen embryo would be used up in the last pregnancy attempt, but we live in the real world. So there may be excess embryos that are frozen that the couple no longer wants to utilize as another attempt for pregnancy. I guess the question is, if so, then what? And Dr. Lowerly, what options are available for couples for what to do with any excess frozen embryos that they might have?
Well, generally there's three options available. They can have the embryos thawed and discarded. They can donate the embryos for research purposes, or they can donate the embryos to another couple who would then use the embryo to in their own family-creating endeavors.
And you and Dr. Ruth Faden have done some of the latest research on what people are actually, what people are saying that they would likely do. And what did you find?
Well, we did. We conducted a study over the last couple of years in which we sent a survey to more than 2,000 fertility patients at nine fertility centers across the country. This was a 12-page questionnaire. It was quite detailed, and we were delighted to have a 60% response rate.
Mm-hmm.
The first lesson of that very high response rate for me was not just that we had done good science, but really that this was a very important, vital question in the minds of people who had embryos in cryo storage.
I certainly have found that in my research for the book. It is amazing how much people actually, there's so little out there for people, and they're so anxious to talk about it because they have no one to talk about it with.
Well, absolutely. And we did some research, some qualitative research leading up to this survey that we sent out. And one of the things that we heard was that at the time that their embryos were frozen, at the time they decided to cryopreserve their embryos, they were not thinking that they would be in a position to have to dispose of them. They maybe way in the back of their minds, they thought it was a possibility, but as they were creating these embryos, the last thing they were thinking about or wanted to think about was the eventuality of what they would do to dispose of them, whether that meant destroying them or giving them to somebody else, because at that point, emotionally, they felt like these embryos were precious and they were their potential children. And so when they come to this place, the decision about embryo disposition is really an unexpected conundrum. They've mm-hmm. been through a lot of emotional and situational experience through the course of their fertility treatment. Their thoughts about reproduction have evolved, and now they're facing a choice that they really didn't anticipate.
That's exactly what I hear. You hear over and over, I never in a million years thought this is going to be what I would have to face, because by the time they've gotten to this point, most people have tried for years and years to have a child. And when these are frozen, keep in mind that they do not even know yet whether they are going to be pregnant from the fresh transfer. So they really don't think in ahead. So go on and tell us what you found out as far as what their options, what their preferences were for their with their options.
Well, we were quite surprised because you had mentioned a study in 2003 which indicated not only that there were about 400,000 embryos in storage, but that the vast majority of these embryos were intended to be used for pregnancy attempts. What we found instead, and that about between 2 and 3% of them were intended to be used for research, to be donated for research. What we found instead was that about half of the people who returned our survey said that they would be somewhat or very likely to donate their embryos for research. And when we asked about specific types of research, stem cell research, research to improve fertility care, research to address diseases like Alzheimer's disease, likelihood of donating embryos for research went up to around 60%. So in contrast to the broad presumption that the embryos currently stored are intended for reproduction, we found something different. In addition, we found, again, perhaps surprisingly, that a very low percentage of people considered themselves somewhat or very likely to donate their embryos to another couple or to thaw and discard them. So that was for the somewhat and very likely, that was in the 20% realm. And if we just look at the very likely, it was 7% or less who had inclinations to choose any other option besides research. So now you see a conundrum taking shape, right? So there is an inclination toward research, but there are restrictions of various kinds, which I know you'll get to in perhaps some today and some future shows. And then
Stop here and ask Ms. Elster, could you tell us what the restrictions, just kind of briefly, because you're right, we will be discussing them at length on the June 4th show, and then I'll come back to you, Dr. Lowerly, with your research. What are the restrictions, Nanette, on research right now?
Well, currently there's very limited funding for any research involving stem cell research, for example, which some people are interested in, and any research that results in the destruction of embryos cannot receive federal funding. And this often happens. Plus, we have several states with laws that are a little bit contrary. So they suggest that that certain kinds of research cannot be done. Other states do actually provide funding for the research to be done. We don't have any specific legal guidelines at the federal level. In fact, for example, consent in this arena, although we do have some guidelines which say that the progenitors must consent, they must consent at the appropriate time. And I raise that because the one thing that we haven't mentioned is when things get even more complicated, where one of the gametes in the embryo might be donated, so donated sperm or donated egg, and then trying to determine what can or should happen with those embryos, particularly in the research arena. So it really becomes difficult, and I find this in my own practice, that couples who wish to donate often find that there are roadblocks in their way because of various state laws, because of federal regulations. They don't have any place to donate to. And so they then become a little bit overheard in some sort of quandary because that was their first choice, and now they don't know where to go from there. So the laws, again, are state by state and are very confusing. Some states, for example, actually fund research. So California is the best example.
Mm-hmm.
And Illinois is another state that does provide funds for research, particularly stem cell research, when I'm talking about these funding restrictions. But if you look at some states, their statutes don't really keep up with what's happened with IVF. And so when we're talking about embryo research, it hasn't contemplated many of the things that could happen now or the fact that we might be dealing with embryos outside the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so those laws, if interpreted strictly, could restrict any kind of research. And there's probably about, I'd say, somewhere between 15 and 20 laws that could be interpreted to restrict all kinds of research involving embryos.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a sure thing, although this might be a preference. It may, when the time comes to actually do it, may not be an available option.
That's the conundrum that Dr. Lyerly was speaking of.
Exactly.
Yes. You're listening to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. Today, my guests are Dr. Anne Drapkin-Lyerly, a professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and at the Trent Center for Bioethics, Humanity, and History of Medicine. All of that is at Duke. Nanette Elster, a bioethicist and an attorney specializing in genetic and reproductive law, and the director of the, Nanette, tell me quickly, I didn't write it down.
The Health Law Institute at DePaul University College of Law.
Thank you. And Dr. Michael Tucker, an embryologist and the scientific director at the Georgia Reproductive Specialist and at the scientific director at Shady Grove Reproductive Science Center. Science Center, that's correctly. Dr. Lyerly, you mentioned that you also interviewed some of the, I realize that the majority of your study was based on a survey, but you had said you interviewed some of the people who filled out the survey. Did you get a feel in those interviews for what criteria people were using for making the choices or why, what feelings they had that lent them to making the decisions that they did or thought that they would make?
Well, we did. We actually did. The interviews that we did, we interviewed about 50 fertility patients, and those interviews preceded the survey. And so we were able to identify some of those concerns and considerations, and then we could measure them among our broader sample more quantitatively. One of the things that struck me in perhaps most profoundly in the qualitative work and which bore out in the quantitative work was the contrast between the ways that people deliberate privately about their embryos and the way that the public debate has occurred. So there is, as everyone knows, this very public debate about stem cell research in which people have really focused in on the question of what is the moral status of the fetus, of the embryo. So if the embryo is valued a lot, is near in value to a born child or a fetus, then that would direct us, according to the public debate, away from research or embryo destruction of any sort. Well, if you didn't value your embryo as much, then research or destruction would be permissible. However, when we listened to people, we heard something very different, which was as people went through the process of fertility treatment, they saw how embryos could become the children that they loved. They became less enthusiastic about the idea of that embryo becoming a child in any family except their own. They used very moral language to describe this concern. In some talks, I've used the term parental responsibility. So they had these moral concerns about doing anything with the embryo except either using it for themselves or destroying it. So that's one of the reasons that research emerged as an interesting thing, because they did not like the idea of the embryo being in somebody else's body or that child being in somebody else's life, but they wanted some good to come out of the process and some good to come out of the creation of this embryo. One of the interesting things that we heard about research, too, though, was when people expressed concern about research, again, it wasn't just, well, it might be morally wrong to destroy an embryo, but it was, what if researchers allowed this embryo to become a baby? Then that would be really bad. And so the moral status question was sort of flipped on its head, or at least given a very different had a different logic to it. Value was associated with options that resulted in embryo destruction.
And I have found that in my interviews exactly the same, that people feel it's almost the whole issue of whether of personhood really doesn't factor in, because regardless of what you call it, they feel a responsibility, and I like your use of the word a parental, on some level, a responsibility towards the embryo. And they're the ones making the decision. And 201, I have yet to interview somebody who didn't feel that it was very important to do what is right, if they only knew what the right and whatever right would be. We're going to devote the next two shows to the options of donating to another infertile couple and the option of donating to research. So I'd like to shift our talk today to the option of thawing and discarding. And Dr. Tucker, it's my understanding that the actual thaw process is a very quick one. Is that correct?
Yes. In essence, we merely take the embryos directly out of the storage container at the low temperature, and without any to do, just allowing those embryos to warm up, without any appropriate protocol to the thawing, because normally if we're seeking to keep those embryos alive, they need to be washed free from the cryoprotectant. That's the antifreeze chemicals that the embryos are lodged in. We need to get them out of there and get them back into culture within a relatively short period of time. If we just neglect to do any of that, the mere act of drawing the embryo out of the liquid nitrogen and allowing it to warm to room temperature and just leaving it there, those embryos are effectively terminated very quickly. Now, that is undertaken on a very respectful basis. This is not something we do lightly, and demand a fully executed document to indicate that both owners, as it were, both partners involved in the generation of that embryo have agreed to this disposition, this approach to disposal. It's not something we take lightly in the lab at all. And there are indeed some couples, and I think Dr. Lyerly was great in pointing out the difference between the public and the private debate. I think it cannot be stated strongly enough just how personal an experience infertility therapy and the consequences of, including frozen embryos, can be. And these couples do not take this process lightly, generally speaking, either. And there are some couples who actually request for a sort of a private handing off of those embryos so that they can actually perhaps go and bury them under a tree in their yard or something of that nature. So it's a very personal experience.
Well, I wanted to talk a bit about that, about the options. Many couples think that once it's just a finite decision, okay, we will discard them. And yet there are other that just starts the process of choices they then have to make. I mean, one is to allow the clinic to ethically discard the embryos. And what does that mean? What exactly happens? So if a couple wanted to allow the clinic to do it, what happens there? Walk us through that.
Well, I mean, not to be too graphic, but I mean it's just a very practical arrangement, and having allowed the embryos to sit for some, we normally allow like an hour at room temperature.
Mm-hmm.
We will then, without actually even opening the container within which the embryo or embryos are held, we will then sign off on all the paperwork, verify that this is the correct disposition for this embryo,
mm-hmm.
and quite simply, the material is placed in the biohazard waste. So it's pretty
unceremonious.
Unceremonious. But let me just back up by saying that this is not something that we as embryologists seek to do or do at all lightly.
I hear that.
We tend to accrue a number of these embryos for disposition, and then one of us within the lab will go through this process and have a second person verify. We really struggle to utilize every embryo that mm-hmm. we generate in the IVF lab, so we hate throwing away frozen embryos. One of the things that we've done, which has improved this situation over the last few years, is to freeze embryos at the later stage of development. And
mm-hmm.
in fact, we freeze fewer embryos at that stage, because fewer embryos actually grow in culture for up to nearly a week to a point that are potentially viable for freezing. So that's cut down on the numbers that we have left over. And if you don't mind me just throwing out maybe a vision of the future of where IVF may go,
mm-hmm.
to try and obviate this issue with the co-ownership, as it were, of these frozen embryos, is the potential with the vast improvement in egg freezing, that is the unfertilized egg freezing, that technology has come leaps and bounds in the last 10 years, and the potential for us to limit insemination to only two or three eggs, and freeze the excess eggs, thereby leveling the playing field, should we say, trying to put things back a little bit more in the woman's camp, giving her the sole ability to direct what she wishes to do with her mm-hmm. eggs at that frozen stage, and obviating the potential for having excess embryos for freezing. I think we're a ways from that
mm-hmm.
Approach routinely, but nevertheless, that's a very good option to have out there.
Yeah, and I was actually going to end the show talking about the advances in the field. But before we get there, let me go back. You mentioned that it would be possible for couples to have, for a lack of better words, some form of ceremony. And I hear periodically that this is something that people want. Is that possible? And can this be arranged within your clinic?
We don't have any formal program to facilitate couples in that. We merely will go to great lengths to get them, if they want their embryos still at the frozen state, to perhaps take to a cemetery or funeral home or something, to have a rather more formal process for the disposal of those embryos, then we will get those embryos to that couple, or we will hand them off to them in a small cooling shipper, a freezing
mm-hmm.
shipper,
something
which
along.
Allows them, and we'll give them instructions how to remove the sample, the vessels containing the embryos, to allow them to undertake the actual, disposal of the embryos themselves.
In the privacy of their own home. Ms. Elster, is there any laws related to the handling of a human tissue in any way? Is that problematic, or is that something that can be done easily?
It's something that generally can be done pretty easily, and the few times that it's come up in our practice, we've often recommended and made referrals to discussion with mental health professionals who have expertise in determining, you know, what ritual might be most comforting or most
mm-hmm.
easing for a couple in this process. So there certainly are people who feel just that way, and some people who wish to have things done more ceremoniously, even though recognizing what the ultimate end point is.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as laws that would be restrictive, there don't seem to be anything, there doesn't seem to be anything in particular. Certainly concerns about biohazardous material and tainted material, those are things that do need to be disposed of in very particular ways according to state law.
But embryos, frozen embryos would not fall under that category?
Typically not, unless we run into a particular circumstance where those embryos might be embryos created from, for example, an HIV serodiscordant couple.
So it would have to be a situation such as that. That's interesting. I didn't know one way. What about the option of a compassionate transfer? Dr. Lyerly, are you familiar with that term? I'm sure you are. And can you tell us what that option is for couples?
Well, I think I know what you're talking about. So in our research, we again, in our qualitative research and then in our survey, there actually is a demand for these alternative and respectful ways to thaw and dispose of embryos. Not to say that the usual processes aren't respectful, but to add a level of ritual or meaning that makes people feel like they've, again, done the best thing that they could possibly do with these entities they've created. And so, again, we heard about people wanting a ceremony, but we also actually time and again heard women say that they wished there was a way that the embryos could be put back in their body, either their vagina or their uterus at a time that they would be unlikely to conceive.
Mm-hmm.
So is am I getting at the right thing?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe that's not the I've always heard that called a compassionate transfer, but it's obviously could be called different things.
Yeah, well, I like that term, but and I do think that it's quite a compassionate transfer. You know, there's all sorts of interesting interpretations of why people think that would be something that is comforting. But, you know, interestingly enough, this is not offered in proactively by centers across the country. You know, I saw one survey that said that only about 5% of centers will bring up these options, which I think is an interesting thing given the prevalence of interest in these.
That's interesting.
I do have a reason why this has happened, as the situation has presented itself a couple of times in my experience. And this is the program's attorney saying, no, there's too much liability. If it's not medically necessary or medically indicated, the potential risks don't outweigh the benefits, has been the analysis from counsel. And that is a potential risk of infection, any of the typical risks, which I think, you know, the other speakers could discuss much better than I could. But it's that concern that if there is not a medical need, then this is running too much of a risk of liability on the part of the program.
And you're speaking of being able to transfer the frozen embryo into the woman, either her vagina or uterus, at
right,
a time
knowing
where...
knowing that this is not an appropriate time...
Right, where
where it might not... And while my concern here is that we might not be evaluating the emotional benefits as greatly as we should.
Yeah, I would
think
so. When
we're doing that risk-benefit analysis.
Yeah, I would think so, too, because from what Dr. Lyerly is saying, there is a you found that there was an interest in, and it's not that the normal way that a clinic disposes because is disrespectful, because I hear time and again, and certainly from what Dr. Tucker is saying, the utmost respect is being given to it, but that perhaps on an emotional level for people, one step more ritualistically is helpful. And I'm surprised that only 5% of the clinics present this as an option.
Well, so there's a...
Oh.
Well, I was just going to... I wanted to clarify that, and then I will step back from the microphone. But that was just whether it was offered proactively. I have actually heard from a lot of fertility specialists across the country that if asked, they will do this.
Okay.
But it's not offered to people. And so I think... And when I look at the language of our qualitative research, I could always tell when somebody was going to talk about this because they danced around it for a couple of minutes. Oh, this is really weird, but there's this thing I just have been thinking of, and, well, let me tell you. And I just always knew what they were going to say. And so, you know, if you think about a patient in a physician-patient relationship, bringing up an option that's not offered, and, of course, maybe our fertility patient population is a little different than the general population, but there is a difference between having the burden of this, you know, fifth option or fourth option, if you will, being brought up by a patient versus being offered by an institution. So, but
if I could just weigh in on that, I think that I've been doing this for 25 years now, and have undertaken that approach to embryo disposal for couples on about 5 occasions. I was just trying to do the numbers in my head, and I think that's a great comment that we need to be more proactive in that, because I think Nanette Elster's comment about that some physicians feel that this is not indicated medically can be problematic. I think that's just, that makes my skin crawl. That's such defensive medicine. It's like,
no, it's not the physicians. It's the lawyers for the physicians.
Yeah,
I
was just,
that's
funny.
Why
I was
never
listening. Nanette, I was thinking the same thing.
No,
both of
no,
us
no,
attorneys are going to say.
Absolutely, I don't even want to suggest that. It's the lawyers suggesting
that. They hire.
But from a medical standpoint, and okay, I'm just a lab rat, not an MD, but the potential for infection or any problem arising from what is an incredibly non-invasive procedure, that's the actual embryo transfer process.
Yeah.
Gosh, if we can't get it right in the handful of cases that we do these transfers at an inappropriate time to try and generate pregnancy, you know, we're doing a bad job. I mean, we do so many of these transfers in trying to attempt pregnancy, and we never, but the incidence of infection or any problem arising from that is so minuscule that in those handful of cases where we would undertake this not to achieve pregnancy but to console a woman or a couple in through this process, I applaud that approach. And anyway, I just
well,
had
now
to
this
say
may be a silly question, but can they be incinerated, you know, or is there any, if you did, would there be, I mean, we're talking about a one cell, you know, something that is microscopic. I almost hesitate to ask, but if that was, we think in terms of cremation and having ashes of loved ones, that type of thing, and is that an option?
If I can comment, just, I've actually, in my years of doing this, had one couple who actually that did take their were embryo containing straws, 3 of them, to a funeral parlor and actually had a formal cremation undertaken. There's no reason why you can't do that. Of course, it's a fairly excessive from my standpoint, but
would there be any remains of a, we're talking something microscopic, would there be any, as somebody said, that would be one ash, not ashes. I mean, would there be anything to take home?
It would be more to do with the actual container, the plasticware that contained the in a sterile condition. But there wouldn't awfully be a great deal of organic tissue there to remain as ashes.
So. Okay, so that's all right. Yeah, so there wouldn't be a. There would not be anything really.
It's more of a concept than a reality, shall we say, in terms of, you know, carrying home your urn with some ashes in it. Anyway.
Well, I think it sounds like that's what we're talking around, is allowing options for people to close the circle in a way that feels comfortable to them. And in nothing, and I don't think any of us mean to imply that if somebody chooses to simply check the box that says, discard, you know, an ethical discard by the clinic is certainly fine, but for some people, they might want more associated with it.
If I could just, I mean, we've talked about with an emphasis on the compassion or the deep interest that the couples have in their embryos, there is another side to this coin, which may be a little bit off the topic, but those embryos, those couples that come through seeking a certain sex of offspring who are very happy to undertake the concept of generating embryos of both sexes and choosing just one and getting us to dispose of the non-wished-for sex. It surprises me that there seem to be, and equally those couples that go missing, knowing full well that they have embryos in storage, they represent a whole different population of couples that perhaps aren't being covered in this discussion, which are the ones that really lack, potentially as I see it, the compassion for those frozen embryos that they may have stashed away in our labs, which sort of throws the onus of what to do with those embryos back onto us. And as far as they're concerned, well, somebody can throw them in a biohazard box and we really, you know, won't think twice about it. So I think it's important to focus on the compassionate disposal of these embryos, but it surprises me, has routinely over the years, the number of couples who really have the very opposite approach, and they don't see any great value to the reproductive tissue that they have stashed in our freezers.
I think that's a really great point about abandoned embryos. And this is something that, although the only thing we have are guidelines from the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, most programs that I'm familiar with, even though the guidelines say if you've tried to contact for a period of time, 5 years, can't contact, fertility centers can destroy the embryos. This isn't a law, it's a regulation. And without it's a recommendation by a professional society. Given that, many programs don't feel comfortable going ahead and taking that next step, which, as you mentioned, Dr. Tucker, puts the centers in a very precarious position and doesn't necessarily accord a level of respect for those embryos.
But I think it might be a little bit dangerous to say that if somebody's abandoned their embryos, that is equated with them not valuing them. I mean,
No. It may more so, and what I've seen it be is more so people don't want to think about what they've been through.
Exactly.
And it's not compassionate toward the embryos per se, but it's not thinking about them anymore, and it's really not giving that thought up front that we hope the discussion yields in an informed consent process. It's more a matter of we're done, we've accomplished what we wanted to or didn't, and we don't want to go back to that place that may have unpleasant feelings or memories or that you just really want to forget.
Or it's not an easy decision. And I hear from people is that generally they try not to think about it, and they don't think about it until they receive their annual or biannual cryopreservation bill. And then they look at it and they talk about it then, and then it's the fourth option that's not mentioned, which is the decision not to decide. You know, for $500 or for $1,000, you know, I'd rather pay it and not have to make the decision. So I think that's, I get the feeling that's part, at least for some people, that's it.
And I have clients who would be willing to pay indefinitely.
I agree with you that I was talking with an embryologist yesterday, and he was saying this is a real problem for clinics. And I said, well, you know, there's a solution. I'm not encouraging you to do this, but if the price gets high enough, and in fact, another couple I interviewed said that until their eldest was wanting to go to camp, and I don't know what their bill was, it was maybe, I think it was like $1,500. It turned out to be very similar to her tuition for summer camp. And they said, you know, this will help. It helped them decide. All of a sudden they were weighing it, and they said, you know what, we need to decide. You know, we would much rather send, I think she was 7 or 8, you know, and we've had these in storage for 8 years. Let's decide.
Well, that's part of the problem is the decision is made at a point in time that probably, and the information is provided about making that decision at a point in time when I think most people aren't ready to make the decision. And so I think not just re-upping storage fees or any of that, but I think throughout this process, and especially because informed consent should be an ongoing process always, that there needs to be a reconsenting that goes on periodically. The information we have about what can and should be done with embryos is variable over time. How people feel about them is going to change over time.
And the research shows, and in fact, that it does. It does change.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Yeah. Well, we are out of time. I was going to sum up, but thank you. Dr. Tucker has already done that. Some of the advancements in the field of reproduction that are going to change the horizon as far as how many embryos are stored. Egg freezing certainly is one, and I think as Dr. Tucker so sufficiently mentioned earlier, the ability now to grow embryos to a later stage, therefore having fewer embryos, but the ones you do freeze are more likely to actually implant. Those,
right.
And I'm sure there are other advancements as well that will change the future as to the number. Thank you, Drs. Lyerly and Tucker and Annette Elster, for being here today and for sharing your vast expertise and experience. I think it has been very helpful. You've been listening to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. The show is live every Wednesday from 12 to 1 Eastern Time. You can replay this show or download it as a podcast from iTunes, and you can get both the replay and the podcast from creatingafamily.com. The next 2 weeks we will have shows on embryo disposition options. The next week will be the 28th will be on donating your embryos to another culture, to another couple. And on June 4th, we will talk about the option of donating your embryos to research. In June, I have 3 great adoption shows coming up, I will next week go through them. We're out of time here. According to the CDC, 7.3 million people are infertile. If you are suffering with this disease, and it is a disease, you are not alone. There are resources available to help. You can find some of these resources at creatingyourfamily.com. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today, and I will see you next week.